Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden. I'm an author, keynote speaker, executive coach, and it's my absolute pleasure to have you with us today for this episode. I've been looking forward to this for a very long time. As soon as it was booked in the calendar, couldn't wait to start this conversation. It's amazing to think we're approaching 100 episodes. It's just been an absolute blast to have these discussions. And because of your ongoing support, the Do Good to Lead Well podcast is now heard in 106 countries around the world. So we're truly global. We are rated in the top 0.5% of podcasts globally. And that could not happen without your ongoing support, your ideas, and your suggestions. So thank you for that. The primary reason why this podcast has garnered such a large following is because of amazing guests. And as I've shared, I'm going to reference this book multiple times throughout the conversation today. Urs Kunig, who I'm thrilled to have with us today, is one of those reasons. Just an outstanding guest, global thought leader, has done so much in so many different ways. I'm going to provide a brief bio. I cannot recommend this book enough. I'm going to show it to you as I love to do, because I'm an old school highlighter type of person. So you can see, you can almost name a page and I'll have something highlighted there. So in my work, I have the incredibly good fortune of receiving advanced copies of upcoming books. And I was one of those fortunate readers to review Radical Humility. And I'd say it was an inspiring and thought-provoking read. Urs is a former United Nations military peacekeeper and NATO military peacekeeping commander, a highly accomplished ultra-endurance champion, a widely published professor, and a seasoned executive coach and keynote speaker with more than three decades of experience helping hundreds of leaders and dozens of executive teams unlock new levels of achievement across four continents. So truly a global thought leader. He is the founder of the Radical Humility Leadership Institute and speaks frequently on the topic of leadership to corporations and associations around the world. His message of radical humility and leadership has inspired teams from across the spectrum, including Amazon, Starbucks, the Society of Human Resource Management, Vistage, the University of Melbourne, and Microsoft. So that's just a brief introduction. And so, Urs, very warm welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well universe.
Thank you so much for having me. And I have to say, I love your title. It's that's a great title. You know, it's close to my heart to do well. So amazing work on the success of your podcast. So congratulations on that. I'm thrilled to be here and I'm happy to engage with your audience as we go along.
Well, thank you so much. And yes, as Urs kindly mentioned, he's open to receiving your questions. So please, you have an opportunity to ask questions to a top global thought leader. Fantastic book on radical humility. So many powerful lessons in there. And I have to say, what I love on my side, just you've accomplished so much in so many different domains. And I love that combination of science and practice. It's a huge passion of mine. So I love that you reference the evidence. And then also talk about how we can translate these research findings into leadership and life practice. So I can't wait to dive in with you on this, Urs, this afternoon. I'd love to start with, so what inspired you to write the book? And also, I love the title, Radical Humility. So let's start there.
Absolutely. I always have, on a personal level, been drawn to people who are deeply humble and who let their achievements speak for themselves. So I have a background in ultra sports, as you mentioned, sort of in the macho, uber-competitive ultra-cycling world. I admired people, my fellow racers, who let their legs do the talking versus a big mouth. So I was always drawn to folks like that. As an executive coach, as you mentioned, as we came out of the financial crisis in 2008-09, and as social media started to explode, I experienced my clients almost always being a step behind. They were, many of them, still leading top-down command control, centralized leadership from the top, and they were always a step behind. So that got me for the first time with a bit more seriousness thinking about, well, maybe we need to look at a different kind of leadership. And then a couple of things happened. I deployed on my first peacekeeping mission to the Balkans in 2017, and then my second one 2 years ago to the Middle East. And ironically, transferring back into a hierarchical and very traditional organization like the military, a peacekeeping force, an international force, actually showed me that the best commanders, the best officers are deeply humble. They develop deep self-awareness, and we can talk more about the definition of radical humility. They build meaningful relationships with their team members. They show up with vulnerability, even in the military. They say when they messed up, and they deploy, you know, what we call the growth mindset. So that got me then really thinking, well, there's something here with humility and the effectiveness in leadership. And then, of course, the COVID crisis also brought humility front and center. When the world shut down, we all had to humbly admit, up to the highest office in the country, that we have no clue what's going on, and we have actually very little control of our own lives. So those two things, the peacekeeping missions and then the COVID crisis, sort of got me started on my quest to really research humility, not just as a personal trait, but as a leadership tool. And then I dug into the research, and then, you know, the result of that quest is the book.
And it's, as I said, it's so well written, so many great insights. And I love the combination of you referring to the science and in terms of its application to leadership, as well as your own personal stories and examples, which I think are wonderfully illuminating. And so you talked about radical humility and the definition. Maybe you can unpack that for us, because I'm sure for people listening, go, wow, okay, radical humility.
Right, yeah. So radical humility, of course, I'm saying this a bit tongue-in-cheek, makes for a great title, does it not, right? So my point is, you can't half-ass humility. So that's why radical. But so let's look at actually the definition. And this is based on my own research. And on the research, is if we go back, Jim Collins was the first author in Good to Great who talked about humility as a strength. And then, of course, Edgar Schein in his Humble Leadership book. Radical humility has three main tenets. It's first and foremost, deep self-awareness, deep self-knowledge. So, you know, this is obviously for us who are in the coaching world, close to our hearts. Like, I want to see myself in line with how others see me. I'm constantly asking for feedback. I'm, as I say, a feedback scout. I'm constantly looking at seeing myself in line with how others see us. That's the first thing. The second piece is leading relationally. So we're facing an inversion of expertise today, meaning our people always know so much more than we ever can about their specific area. For them to come to us with the data and information we so clearly rely on as their leader, they need to trust us. And the only way that they can trust us is if we build meaningful relationships with them. So I'm advocating from solely leading by content expertise to leading relationally, building collaborative and trusting relationships with our team members. And then the third piece I was briefly alerting to before is the famous growth mindset. So seeing mistakes and failures by ourselves and our team members as opportunity for learning and growing versus something to be ashamed of, or worse even, sweep under the carpet. So these are the three main tenets of leading with radical humility.
And I love that. And in particular, and one of the mantras for this podcast is great leadership starts with great self-leadership, and that starts with self-awareness. And so I love that message, and it's so important and so powerful. And what I really appreciate, Urs, about what you highlight as well is that the world is changing so rapidly, we must adopt a perspective, a philosophy, approach whereby we can get access to the information that's just flowing all over the place so we can make the best informed decisions. I'm not surprised. We have a question already. So Gregory was wondering, so I love this idea of humility and leadership. Yet when I look in the media sometimes, it seems like the leaders that get a lot of attention aren't humble. How do I make sense of that?
Yes, that's, you know, it's a great question and a question I get asked so often. How come you advocate for humility in leadership when clearly there's so many folks out there who don't lead with humility and who enjoy success? So a couple of things. First of all, like science one-on-one. Simply because we have leaders who have success and are, frankly, I don't know if I can say this, arrogant jerks sometimes, some of them are, doesn't mean that there is a causality. So the difference between correlation and causality. We don't know what would have happened to this organization if they would have been led by a humble leader. I would argue most likely they probably would have been even more successful. So that's the first one. And then there, of course, is the rare leader. You know, Steve Jobs comes to mind, who was fired from his first job for saying, your work is SHIT, right? He clearly was, early in his career at least, not humble. Later in his career, and actually much less known, is that Steve Jobs embraced intellectual humility in great depth. He would say, I don't care if I'm wrong. I just want to get it right. And so definitely there is, you know, if we are convinced that we're the rare leader of the caliber of Steve Jobs, you know, we don't have to embrace humility. I agree with you. But for most of us mere mortals, you know, Craig, you and I, and many of our listeners, I do believe and strongly make the case that humility is the ticket for success. While there's certainly plenty of highly visible figures out there who are not humble, there is a ton of leaders under the radar because they're humble, letting their team members shine, achieving amazing success. I mean, if we just, one more example, look at the transition of power at Microsoft. Steve Ballmer was certainly not a humble leader. But what happens now, or what happened over the last 10 years, are the new Microsoft leader who is incredibly humble, who puts learning and the growth mindset at the center of everything we do. So that's a great example of a humble leader.
And lots of great comments coming in. So thank you for that answer, Urs. And what I really appreciate is that powerful counter question that you asked. Imagine what would the world have been like if they adopted a different approach? And we can oftentimes, I'm so glad you make that challenge, that assumption that, oh, well, this is a cause. So because of their narcissism, because of their arrogance, they're successful. And I think it's such a powerful question to reflect on back to self-awareness about, imagine if they weren't that arrogant jerk. What more they could have accomplished? Because you see lots of great examples. And I love that you just highlighted the Microsoft case, whereby a shift in leadership, look at the extraordinary success that Microsoft has experienced under that style of leadership. I've got another question coming in, not surprised. I have a whole list, and I'm glad to see this is what happens. Sarah was saying, again, love this idea. I'm wondering about, will people see me as weak if I'm humble?
So that's, Sarah, that's an excellent question. So I want to make one point very clear. Humility in leadership is no replacement for competency. We can do all the listening in the world, all the engaging, all the providing the psychological safety. If I'm losing my company money because I'm missing an industry trend, because I'm technically not competent myself, then all the humility will not save the day. So I want to be very, very, very clear about that. It's no replacement for competency. To come back to the question of, will they see me as weak? So let me actually sort of answer this in a roundabout way, Sarah. Often people challenge me on that. So how can I be confident? How can I be ambitious and still humble? And my comeback is this. Humility and confidence actually go hand in hand. If you think about it, for me to go to my team and ask for feedback on what I can do better, and let's face it, we all have blind spots. All of us can always get better. I actually need to be fundamentally confident in my skills and my abilities as a leader to really ask that feedback and hear it and then be able to act on it. So rather than being a contradiction, humility and confidence actually go hand in hand. I have to have a strong sense of self to show up with vulnerability, which we can talk about this as well, which is part of humility. The second piece around this is people often think I can't be ambitious and humble at the same time. And yet, again, I would argue they go hand in hand. What does ambition look like? Ambition looks like asking ourselves, why are we failing potentially? Why are we not as successful as we can be? What's the way forward? And what's my part in this? And that requires humility to ask these questions. But asking these questions, that's the exact definition of success. Going deep and asking the deep, hard questions. So again, ambition and humility in my book go hand in hand. Being a humble leader does not mean you're an emotional doormat. Absolutely not. The last thing I say about this is, Craig and I would probably agree on that, leadership is not a popularity contest. I always ask, I always listen, I always thank for the input, but I get to decide what I'm working on. When we do 360s with our clients, you know, it's not evidence, it's data, it's perceptions, and I get to decide what I want to focus on because I'm not naive. Everybody has their own agendas as well.
Absolutely. And I love that. And again, a great answer. Thank you so much. Very helpful, very insightful. So lots of positive comments coming in that I'm not surprised. And I really appreciate how you are highlighting that piece because sometimes there is that perception that, oh, well, humility, it's a signal of weakness. And I love how you highlight as well. And that's something that I really appreciate throughout your book because where you'll say, hey, humility cannot replace competence. And as you said, if you're losing millions of dollars for your company, that's not going to solve that piece. And I think that's a really powerful idea to sit in. And then also, I love how you expand it and say, well, it's more of an and than an either or. It's humility and competence. It's humility and ambition. And it was one of the cool insights in the book. It's like, well, when you ask for feedback, there's humility and there's strength in that because you're showing I'm open
exactly.
to receiving some critical comments. So absolutely great. And I do want to, I'm going to take this opportunity. I know there are more questions because you did talk about trust and I know you're very passionate about that. And if you look at the trust data around the world and all kinds of different surveys, it's going down. We're in rough water, shall we say. And then you talk about how vulnerability is a vital entry point in building trust. And I love how you approach that. And I know that's a big, big part of the work that you do. So can you lead us through the link between those two ideas?
Absolutely. Let me actually start with a personal experience. A couple of years back in my peacekeeping mission in the Middle East, my commanding officer, who was an officer from New Zealand, opened the after action review with these words, I screwed it up. And her ability to own her mistakes with vulnerability upfront, modeling it, then made it safe for all of us, her direct reports, to do the same, to own our own mess ups, all because she went first. So vulnerability does not come after trust, but vulnerability is actually the quickest way to build trust, sharing our shortcomings with our team members. And by the way, for all of us parents on the call, I have two teenage boys with our children too. Sharing our weaknesses or our shortcomings makes us relatable. And by the way, they already know that we're not perfect because they work with us or they live with us every day. And so us publicly acknowledging what we're working on makes us relate. Everybody admires perfection from a distance and nobody can relate to it. And so I actually quote a study, which I absolutely love in the book, and sort of tongue-in-cheek ask, how long does it take to build trust with vulnerability? How about 45 minutes? So there's this study where pairs of complete strangers are brought into a lab, and they're tasked with asking each other and responding to meaningful questions, such as, what does love and friendship mean to you? Or if you only had 1 year to live, what would you change? When asked to rate the level of trust with their partner 45 minutes, the participants rated the level of trust about as high as the level of trust they have with their average person in their lives. Some of them at the level of trust they have with their significant other, and one pair, and I love this, even got married. So the research is actually, yeah, it's hilarious. Wow. The research is crystal clear. And by the way, appropriate vulnerability is one of the quickest ways to build trust. And one last example, if I may, on this. You know, we all can remember Jacinda Ardern, the former prime minister of New Zealand. She was a tough leader during the COVID crisis, during the Christchurch terrorist attacks. But she shared with vulnerability on many occasions about her life outside of governing country. And so her, you know, openly sharing what it was like to give birth while holding the highest office in the country made her relatable and propelled her to rock star status. And she amassed huge public trust because of that display of appropriate vulnerability.
Well, and again, so many great comments coming in. And I love how you're highlighting the intentionality around that. As you say, like if we walk into a conversation and we really ask the quality of questions that we ask, how we engage with other people, that can expedite that trust building process. And I love how you frame it. And once again, it comes back to the very essence of leadership, or in terms of if you want to see something, go first.
Brené Brown famously says, vulnerability is the last thing I want to show you and the first thing I'm looking in you. And again, I want to be also clear that, you know, we don't have to display our darkest secrets in our first conversation with a stranger. That's not what I'm talking about. So leadership, as we all know, is a thinking person sport. So we will have different levels of vulnerability or different depth of relationships with different people, even on our team. And that's perfectly fine. We're not a fake because we have various depth of relationships and display various levels of vulnerability.
And Susan said, Ors, I love how you touched on the idea of appropriate vulnerability. How do we know where those boundaries are? Can you help a little bit?
Yes, this is a tough one to sort of give, you know, a hard and fast answer to. It's really, again, coming back to the self-awareness, feeling myself into a conversation. With some of our colleagues, it might simply be sharing our weekend plans, right? Mm-hmm. I don't need to tell you about the fight I had with my teenage son last night, you know, or the issues I have in my family dynamics. That's not appropriate, but I can start with small talk about our weekend plans. But with some people, we might actually go to very deep conversations. I had experiences in my life where within 10 minutes, we talked about end-of-life stuff, like unbelievably deep stuff. So it's a question of reading the other person and give and take, like with every conversation. And then we have, of course, cultural differences as well. It was interesting during my peacekeeping missions in very, for our understanding, old school male-dominated societies, how with my male interpreters, I could have very different conversations and they would engage with me very differently than I did with my female interpreters. And it was important for me to have that awareness of what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and how deep can I go.
Pulling out a comment in the comment box, feel your way into the conversation. Yeah. Mic drop quote.
Well said. That's very well said.
There are so many great ideas, and they can be almost counterintuitive or countercultural for most reading. And one of the great parts of the book you talk about, Ors, is around how to fail successfully, like the critical role of failure in terms of driving our success and our advancement. So can you talk about that? Because for some people, it may be failure is something I want to run away from. And again, what I love is you kind of go, wait a second, stay there and think about this. So can you assist us through that journey?
Absolutely. So I want to actually start with talking about an even better book on failing than mine, which is Amy Edmondson's Fail Well book that she published last year. So she distinguishes between different kinds of failures, sort of the simple failures in flying, in a hospital, where you really don't want mistakes and failures. And then she goes to intelligent failures like a scientific experiment where you actually should celebrate the failure because you've learned something. I talk about in the book my biggest athletic failure of my life. I was competing in the 3,000-mile nonstop bike race across America, and the gun goes off in San Diego, and we finish in Atlantic City and the clock stops when we're there. And you must average 250 miles every day to finish and climb well over 170,000 feet. And I ended up in ICU with severe pulmonary edema. My oxygen saturation, that's the thing they put on your finger during your annual physical, was at 42%. I actually almost died. And I was living and dreaming this race for 2 years. I was thinking about it. I was training for it. And here I was in ICU, miserably failed. I was feeling devastated. I was embarrassed. I was feeling guilty for having dragged my crew along with it. And so I learned a lot through coming back from that failure. Because what happens when we fail, specifically when we fail publicly, and I was failing pretty publicly. You know, my whole world knew about this race. I was on the news, blah, blah, blah. So here I'm at ICU. Huge embarrassment. So we get flooded with strong emotions when we fail. And that makes learning from our failures really, really difficult. And so the overarching skill to fail successfully is actually to get out of our hearts, out of our emotions, into our head by reframing. So reframing, going from the unhelpful frame of seeing my mistakes, my failures as proof that I'm not good enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not strong enough, to learning from the experience. And that it's not easy. It's simple, but it's not easy. And it's something we have to practice our whole lives to reframe and dig deep. And, you know, I did my fair share of counseling around this and come back with my own reframe statement. And in my case for the race, it was, this is an important learning stepping stone in my ultra cycling career. So reframing is the overarching skill of failing successfully. If I may, what does Google do? Every time a project fails at Google, it's a time to celebrate. Why? Somebody had the guts and the wisdom to kill a project, and as a result, what? Resources are freed up. So Google reframes from failed project to we just freed up resources. And just to stay with the athletic example, I also talk about Olympic athletes in the book. Who do you think is happier with their medal? Olympic bronze medal winners or Olympic silver medal winners? You know, I can't see a show of hands, but what do you think? Right? So it's surprisingly, it's bronze medal winners. But why? Silver medal winners know how close they've been to gold. And they frame their medal as, I've lost gold at the Olympics. Bronze medal winners, on the other hand, know how easily they could have come home empty-handed. And they frame their medal as, I won a medal at the Olympics, which is amazing. So that simple reframe makes them happier and more satisfied with their medal. So that's a long answer, I realize it, but reframing is really the core strategy, the core skill we need to build to fail successfully and to learn from our failures versus to remain in the unhelpful flooding of emotions that we, all of us, I bet everybody on the call can relate to these strong emotions when we fail publicly.
No, well, and just going through the comments, I'll read a couple saying, great insight in terms of getting out of our emotions and getting into our heads. And someone else wrote, love that you share the medalist story. Amazing. I've never heard that. Awesome insight. And linking it back, and this is one of the profound privileges that I have in hosting this podcast, I get to speak with amazing thought leaders like yourself, globally practice and consulting with top organizations. And I love how you've brought up the skill of reframing. It's something that comes out time and time again. And it reminds me, you mentioned Amy Edmondson's work. And then I had the privilege of speaking with Gary Ridge, the former CEO of WD-40 and chairman of the board. And then categorize them as learning moments, right? Like, hey, what do we take from this? And I love, Ors, how you're showing that in that medalist study, well, how each situation, depending on how we're looking at it, has a profound effect. And once again, that diving deep and self-awareness. Another question that I have for you, I love the section around, and once again, it may be two ideas that people kind of go, oh, this is interesting. You're very passionate about the tough on results, tender on people. And you bring those two together. And in my coaching work, my consulting work, in conversations that I have at different industry events, oftentimes, I probably even the vast majority of the times, people see this as an either or, like I do, I'm one or the other. I love how you link them two together. Can you share more about that?
Sure. Yeah, it is indeed something that I'm very passionate about. And I'm actually, I thought if I ever write a second book, it might be titled Tough on Results, Tender on People. So what does it mean? So it means holding our people to the highest standards while building meaningful and trusting relationships with them at the same time. So in this upfront, the notion that we either have to be a nice person or a tough leader is a false dichotomy. We can, being a good human, as I my subtitle on my book, and executing what needs to get done are not mutually exclusive. So a couple of anecdotes about this. So I was in my peacekeeping mission in Kosovo. That's right. I will never forget. I sat down in my commander's office and I was ready to receive some feedback. And my commander opened and said, "Urs, I love you and this work is not good enough." He literally said this. "I love you and this work is not good enough." His words made me shrink in my chair. And I talk about this more in the book. From that day forward, we turned ourselves inside out to never disappoint him or, frankly, myself ever again. Now, would he have yelled at me? Would he have chewed me out? Would he have been tough on people and tough on results? I probably would have tuned him out. I probably would have just dismissed it. But because he showed me that he deeply and personally cared about me, and not just, of course, you know, because he said, "I love you," because I knew this from our relationship, it made me take his feedback so much more seriously. This is a really important point. Being tender on people gives us license to be tough on results. So our feedback is much more likely to be heard by our team members, our peers, and frankly, our superiors, if we've built meaningful and trusting relationships with them. I share another story in the book during my peacekeeping mission in the Middle East, where I was really firsthand experiencing the value of deep personal relationships to achieve results. I was just finishing a long day of patrolling the ceasefire line between Lebanon and Israel, and I was about to go out for a run when my phone rings, and it's one of my Swiss officers who's deployed in the mission in Syria, and he's in total distress. He's, "Urs, we have a horrific situation. We believe lives are on the line. Nobody's listening. Can you help us in your position as Swiss national senior representative?" So he downloads some more detail. I hang up and I tell it, before I hang up, I tell him that we have a mission leadership meeting the next day and I will bring up his concerns. I hang up, I'm not happy. So now I have to get the commanding officer in Syria into trouble by asking for a change in leadership. And it doesn't help that I'm a newly minted senior. I'm a lower ranking officer than almost everybody at the leadership table. So I will have to work double hard. And so the next day comes along, I outline in no unclear terms the changes that my officers need to see in Syria. And to my amazement, my voice is actually heard at the highest level. My lower rank doesn't get me into trouble. And the concerns of my officers are immediately addressed. And then afterwards, I reflected, why was that? And I believe the short answer is this. Up to this point, I worked really hard on the relationship building without the business agenda up front. So when I was appointed senior a few weeks earlier, instead of boasting with my new position, not the humble way, by the way, I knew to be effective, I needed to build strong collaborative relationships. So I actually literally pulled out the org chart and I circled 30 people who I knew I needed to build meaningful and trusting relationships with, including everybody at the senior leadership table. And then I got to work and I had 30-minute get to know each other meetings with each of these people, even up to senior leadership. Everybody was appreciative of me taking the time and effort to get to know them without the business agenda. And there's no question in my mind that one of the key reasons why my voice was heard, despite my lower rank at the higher level, is because I started to build relationships with these people. And so building bonds with others is a preemptive move. You never know who you have to rely on when the famous stuff hits the fan, as it inevitably will. And so building bonds with others, relationship building, a core element of leading with radical humility, is really a preemptive move. Okay, that's a very long answer. I'm sorry. I'm on a roll here. It's cool.
There's so many comments coming in. Great, great insight. Love this. Lots of great takeaways here. And I really appreciate, again, you're touching on such powerful and humanistic, if you will, aspects, and particularly around that relationship building. I love how you unpack that throughout the book, and you shared your personal examples like the one you just provided, Urs, and how, well, when the things and get sideswiped or crisis evolves, well, now you can really lean in on that currency, that relationship currency. And I love how you bring it back to it's authentic. It isn't manipulative. It isn't about getting ahead. It's, hey, who are you? What's important to you? This is who I am, and this is what's important to me. And we dive as deep as the other person wants to go. Awesome. And now we've created that community. And I just think that's just so, so powerful in terms of setting us up for success.
Thank you for that wrap up. So I think that's a very key point you're making there. I personally believe that to lead people, I actually must love people. Like I must fundamentally love people. I actually would really put this out there. We can debate this on a different podcast. So what that means is that to us as leaders, building relationships should actually come somewhat naturally. We are interested in people. We are interested in how other people tick. It's intrinsically, to your point, it's intrinsically and authentically really what I want to do. I want to learn about you. I want to learn what makes you tick. And at the same time, there is a business purpose. Absolutely. I am strategic about who I build relationships with and where I spend my time and energy, because relationship building is never efficient in the short run. It requires time and energy. And, you know, the payoff might not come for quite some time. But as you correctly said, especially in crisis, existing relationships are so much more valuable than, you know, flow charts and procedures and in the military orders. We need to cut through the red tape, know the right people, so we can get in crisis when stuff needs to happen fast, things done.
Well, and thank you. And I love that you highlighted the idea of love and loving people. And you're right. We could probably have a whole, we'll book another episode on the series to go through that. And what's awesome about what you're talking about, once again, is that, earlier this year, I released an episode with Jan Ryde, the CEO of Hestens, the luxury mattress making company. And he just wrote a book, When Business is Love. And it's all around the rise from when he took over, and there were some really challenging economic headwinds. Now he promised to write a book when the company went to essentially a billion crowns, which is about $100 million US, right? Like just an unbelievable trajectory. Alan Mulally, who collaborated with me on my book, and Ford. What was his primary, which was awesome, at Ford, again, as you're talking about when you think of traditional organizations, at the heart of his working together management system. People first, love them up. So I love how, again, you really get us to reflect on those aspects and say, it's all around being human and expressing ourselves authentically. Just so, so important. Another idea that's in the book, and this is great. You talk about the idea of building a leadership factory, right? Like, so as a humble leader, really one of your primary objectives is to grow others. So out of curiosity, what are some of the key ways that we can really build that leadership factory and pay it forward?
So yes, as you say, the idea is that I make it my explicit goal as a leader to produce the next generation of leaders for our organization out of my team. And just to be clear, by the way, not everybody wants or should get sort of promoted up the chain. There is outstanding individual contributors who, you know, want to become subject experts and gurus. We can promote them in that way. So I often get pushback with this because I can't hold people as it is. Like, you want me to make them even more employable? But the ironic truth, of course, is that we actually hold on to our people longer the more we challenge them and the more we stretch them. And this comes back to the tough and results tender on people. I challenge you to go to the next level. I want you to push yourself. I want you to get ready for the next level. So I'm tough on results. And I deeply and personally care about your career path. So I'm tender on people. So, you know, concrete things that I advise folks to do is, as part of your regular one-on-one, occasionally, whatever it is, like once every quarter, you actually make it a career path meeting. So you specifically talk about these questions that, by the way, are so simple and are never asked enough in business. Where do you see yourself in 1, 3, 5 years? Who do you need to know? Maybe most importantly, what do you need to know? And by the way, why do we not ask these questions enough? We're often afraid of the answer. But of course, as we all know, we ourselves are constantly thinking about our career path. So are our people. So regular career path check-in meetings is one of the best ways to build a leadership factor. And truly thinking about, and then I talk about in the book, these, you know, we're afraid of losing our people. Boomerang effect. We all are aware of the boomerang employees. If we treat our people well, if we let them go gracefully, you know, who knows? Their startup might go belly up in a year and they'll be right back with us, right? So they come home. And then the other one is, if our people get promoted within our organization, they can become ambassadors for us in our organization or in our competitors' organizations or suppliers' organization. And this comes back to this relationship aspect. They become ambassadors, making our life easier. So again, it's one of these things where intrinsically, I want to help you. I want to help my teammate to go to wherever they want to go. And yes, it's also going to benefit me and my team when they actually do move on.
Well, and again, so many great comments coming in and love these ideas. What's fascinating about what you're talking about is, once again, so what happens? We get caught up in the tyranny of busyness and we're just go, 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 go. And just like, here's my to-do list and let's just ram through it. And I think what, once again, what you challenge us to do appropriately and importantly is to say, okay, once a quarter, let's step back and just talk about, so it's almost from a relationship standpoint, right? And where, and what's going on in that person's life and where are they wanting to go and how they want to get there? How do we support them? So powerful. I love the idea of ambassadors because in a world where, again, trust is low and you're looking to recruit the best talent, well, what's a fabulous attraction strategy and retention strategy? And again, to me, what I think is amazing is it really is what you continue to emphasize is that it's relational with ourselves, the relationship we have with ourselves and the relationships we have with others. We want to prioritize those and make them front and center. And I think it's great. I've got more questions coming in. I can't believe we're almost done the hour. And I know you have a flight to catch. So it's awesome. Xavier said, I'm really appreciating the tough on results and tender on people. I sometimes struggle having those difficult conversations around results with members of my team because I don't want to demotivate them. Any tips around how I can approach those conversations or reframe them more effectively?
If we think about the continuum of tough on results and tender on people, all of us over-index to one side. So, you know, we have the hard-nosed, only, you know, tough on results person. And then we have the, and I'm stereotyping here to make the point, we have the conflict-averse leader where nothing ever gets corrected and because we're afraid to demotivate potentially people. So we all fall on the continuum somewhere. And it sounds like you might be falling a little bit more on the tender on people and not enough tough on results. And so what immediately comes to mind is making it about not your standards, but an external agreed upon goal beforehand. In other words, you're not the bad person who's telling your employee or your staff member that they're not delivering. It's not you, but actually it's what we agreed on 3 months ago that you would do. And so sort of depersonalizing it and bringing it back to an agreed upon standard that's not being met. That's the first piece that comes to mind. And then maybe this is a bit too out in the weeds, but what I do with my clients sometimes when I coach is actually role play a conversation like that. And it might seem forced and it can be, but it is incredibly powerful. Actually, even if it's just by yourself, walk through how you're going to frame it, how you're going to approach it and think about potential sort of comebacks or excuses that are being made and how you counter those. That's what comes to mind.
Brilliant. And for me, as a coach myself as well, I love that you highlight the power of role playing, whether it's with a coach or with a colleague or a family member, because I think it's so great to be able to get into that mindset. And then also, as you say, even anticipate, okay, they're probably going to say that. And then you work through it in real time. And Xavier just wrote in, just said, amazing. You're absolutely right. I don't do a good job of having an agreed upon goal. I think that's, and I love that you're highlighting that. And again, so for everybody who's listening and those, if you're listening, you can't see me reference the book.
it's just fantastic because it has these tangible practices that we can use, and they are straightforward. Yet in the busyness and everything we're caught up in, we can overlook powerful opportunities to develop ourselves and develop other people. So I think that's great. One other topic I know you're very passionate about, so I wanted to make sure we had time to talk about this, is psychological safety and transparency, honesty. And so that's just such an essential element of leadership effectiveness. So can you talk a little bit more around what is psychological safety, why it's so important, and some of the key things that leaders can do, or what we can do in our personal lives to build a safer space for really good dialogue and conversation?
Absolutely, yes. And again, by the way, Amy Edmondson at Harvard is the queen of psychological safety. What is psychological safety? It's not standing around in a circle holding hands singing Kumbaya. It's not that. It's about a culture where every team member feels safe to speak up, raise concerns, questions, and doubts without fear of being shamed or worse, risking their careers. It's about being direct. It's about being to the point, inviting feedback, and yes, again, saying, I screwed that up. And so there is plenty of research now. Google was the first one who published it, shows that psychological safety is the best predictor of a team's performance. It's more important than who's on the team, the tenure, the size of the team, virtual or in person. And Google's findings have been replicated, airline crews, surgical teams, variety of industries. So the business case is crystal clear, and yet it's still the exception. So what are some of the things? I have a little framework in my book, what we can do. So the first piece is reframing failure for our team members. I talked about reframing failure for us when I talked about failed successfully. Here we reframe failure for our team members. We say we have the highest goals, we're shooting for the stars, and we know failures will still happen. Quick anecdote on this, actually. Overheard a pilot talking to his crew member, a pilot at the beginning of a flight. The pilot says, I've never done a perfect flight and I'm going to prove it to you again today. And I'm going like, what the hell? And then the pilot says, exactly, right? And he says, I need your help. If you see me do something wrong, I need you to tell me and I'll do the same for you. And we go sitting there like, are you serious? But what actually happens is that pilot is reframing failure for his crew members so they feel safe to speak up. So reframing failure, encouraging speaking up. You mentioned Alan Mulally, who was a champion of encouraging speaking up at Ford because, you know, they were losing billions of dollars and all the famous dashboard indicators were on green. And he goes like, seriously, we're losing billions of dollars. Is nothing going wrong? Until Fields finally spoke up and said, we're holding the launch of, I can't remember now the type of the vehicle, sort of delivering bad news to the boss. And everybody was worried that Fields would get fired. But Mulally actually clapped and encouraged speaking up and said, this is fantastic. So encouraging speaking up, reframe for encouraging speaking up, and then acknowledging and thanking. So this is hard. Even if we disagree with what's brought up to us, thank you for the input. It doesn't mean it's not a popularity contest. It doesn't mean that I'm going to, you know, change everything because you said something, but acknowledging and thanking. And then the last piece, which is often not talked about enough, is the value of experientially learning together with our team members. I talk in the book about these hostage exercises that we had to undergo in our peacekeeping training. I'll tell you, not fun, like blindfolded for hours, stripped down, like humiliated, like horrific, horrific training. And it bonded us as a team immensely. Experiential learning together and me as the commander admitting that I screwed up things left and right, like we all did. And the value of the leader then goes from know-it-all leader, doing everything perfect leader, to embracing, learning, and growing together with my team. And that's one of the most powerful ways to build psychological safety.
Coming back to that idea of reframing for ourselves, it's also an incredibly powerful tool for when we're leading teams and organizations. And also appreciate that experiential learning, what we learn with each other. And once again, I love that story where it's, well, hey, I'm going to mess up some things. You're going to mess up some. Let's help each other. Let's support each other. Let's grow together. This is great. Probably going to be our last question because we're so close to time. So this is fantastic. And Charlene was wondering,
I am starting my career as an executive. And so any advice for me in terms of how I can take the core ideas and radical humility and inform my leadership journey?
You know, that's a really excellent question. So what immediately comes to mind is the notion of constantly asking for feedback and input from mentors and coworkers and your boss on how you can do better when you start out your career. Sort of this embracing the growth mindset. And so that, I think, is a really core element. Coming back to the vulnerability, I also want to say, and maybe this is not directly related to starting your career, but vulnerability, there's times where vulnerability is not always sort of called for immediately. If you, for example, transferring into a very hierarchical organization, if you haven't at all proven yourself, if there's question marks about your technical expertise, then it might not be the best idea to come out of the gate and share all your weaknesses. So I might dial that back a little bit if I'm starting my career, but really embracing the increasing my self-awareness and learning much about how I come across, how I can do better as a leader. So I would really emphasize that. And then relationship building always pays, especially at the beginning of your career. Like, be very intentional about building bonds with others across your organization, outside of your department, like up and down and across your whole organization and industry for that matter.
And thank you again. Great advice. Really helpful. I really appreciate your guidance and other comments coming in. This is great. Wish I had that advice at the beginning of my career. It was another one came in. To me, once again, reverting it back to that intentionality. And it is an idea that I love that you continue to explore and touch on in the book wars around, well, let's be thoughtful. This is not like everything is a hammer and let's go, go, go. What you do is essentially challenge us to say, humility is the best option in the majority of cases. And then we just want to be just like vulnerability. You called it appropriate vulnerability. And I think that empowers us in such a fabulous way to be more mindful, more thoughtful about how we're showing up. And then we're able to leverage those things. Once again, take on that framing and reframing piece. Thank you so, so much, Urs. This has just been so awesome. Again, congratulations. I'm going to highly recommend for everyone to pick up a copy of the book. It is filled with fantastic insights, personal stories. Any final words for our listeners and live attendees before we close our conversation today?
Well, this was really fun. The book is coming out on March 19th, by the way. So it's pre-order now on Amazon and then on March 19th. I loved our conversation. I sincerely hope that you might take away one or two things. I know how this works. You know, we go to these webinars, these trainings, there's a million things, and then we're back in our office and, you know, inundated with emails. But if all of us just pick one thing, it might just deepen one relationship or ask for that one feedback. If all of us on this call commit to doing one thing, like, then my job is done, and I'm just very happy about that. So thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all mine. And I love that, picking one area, and in particular, using and building on the great insight that you shared around relationships. Let's deepen the relationships with the people that we care about most. Once again, book coming out on March 19th. So awesome. Again, I was thrilled to have an advanced copy. I've got it all highlighted already. So Urs, thank you so, so much for the fabulous work that you do. And I really appreciate you sharing your insights with our listeners today. Until next time, everyone, bye for now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.